Radio. At sunrise on a June afternoon, 88 years ago today, the once tranquil area near the Tunguska River in Siberia, that is the lower Tunguska, not the upper Tunguska, nor the stony Tunguska rivers, both of which follow their more famous sister into the swollen Yenisei River, whose interminable journey north from the Tuva Republic to the Arctic Ocean is interrupted only by the occasional hydroelectric barrier and vodka vineyard, and whose fragrant silt is often celebrated in song, though not on today's show because we have been unable to translate the Siberian dialect. Yikes, this is hard to read under that lovely mellifluous tune.
And how many nests into the sentence are we? I've lost track of the subject and predicate.
We are nesting.
We're nesting. We haven't predicated yet.
Not at all.
I see.
We have still nests to go.
Oh, please continue.
With the fourth nest, whose fragrant silt is often celebrated in song, though not on today's show, because we have been unable to translate the Siberian dialect to ensure its appropriateness for radio play, was the site of a tremendous explosion that had the force of a modern H-bomb. Not H as in hydroponics, which coincidentally was the experimental basis of growth for the previously mentioned vodka vineyard, the result of which, newsworthy in its own right, has, like its silt-songed counterpart, yet to be deciphered from the substantially serifed Siberian scrawl, but H as in colossal, hyphen, and which took place at an altitude of several kilometers, period.
Thank you. the several kilometer period.
Right.
Okay.
Shall I continue?
Please continue. Tunguska it is.
Although the explosion flattened trees from Kathmandu to the Irkutsk Farmers Market, from Ulaanbaatar to the Eiffel Tower, no crater was formed, and aside from some microscopic nodules extracted from the soil near Novokainsk, no recognizable fragments remain from what UFOlogists theorize was a mid-air collision between a small, ugly comet and a sleek extraterrestrial spacecraft, a hypothesis bolstered by their acknowledged misinterpretation, exaggeration, and falsification of relevant data. Period. The subsequent observation in the immediate area of what has been termed the Tunguska fireball, or Le Flambeau Orange,
Le Flambeauski Orangikov,
of mile-high luxury townhouses with crystalline roofs and pulsating towers of ivory, surrounded by angular embankments of blue, sponge-like material that reeked of scorched fennel, does lend some credence to their claim. Period. In 1976, 20 years ago today, the structures suddenly vanished. Concomitant with that mysterious disappearance, the Republic of Seychelles, a sleepy archipelago in the Indian Ocean, declared independence from England. Serendipitously enough, the Seychelles Island have for the past 88 years been known for exporting coconuts, cinnamon, vanilla, and patchouli, an enigmatic commodity which have been clinically proven to contain microscopic nodules of extraterrestrial spacecraft fragments. Coincidence? You be the judge. And today is, in fact, Judgment Day on Calvos and Damien's newly named New Music Sesquibazaar, a day when you, our listening audience, may deem what issues forth from your radiophonic speakers as musically appropriate or not, and, in an attempt to imbue our show with extra quality control, we will heed your appraisal and act accordingly, although probably in a manner which is intangible to all but the most vigilant of listeners. In light of this, we rededicate today Vigilante Day and salute the tireless members of the musical militia as they infiltrate and harass those of you who elect to unwind to the soothing strains of a Mantovani LP or the lush arrangements backing a Julie London torch song. So for all of you listeners who for years have been afraid to come out of your easy listening light sounds closet, oh, never mind. This portion of Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar is beholden to no one. And now it's time to empty your minds of all practical thoughts and join us on a euphonious journey down the path of harmonic enlightenment. Your conductor awaits.
As if you didn't know, music by Nick Collins.
Boy, if you listeners were fortunate enough to have headphones, you could listen to that sound bounce from one ear to the other. Not that you would want to.
No, certainly not. That was indeed music by Nick Collins. That was Tobabo Fonio. And Nick Collins is our guest today, unlike what we said last week. We said Barbara Wells would be our guest today. Well, Barbara Wells, she's going on to July 20th.
The well has dried up for today.
For today. She'll be with us on July 20th. So if you've got something better to do on the 20th...
I think we all do. Not that. Well, never mind.
Anyway, so Nick Collins is our guest today, straight from somewhere thousands of miles away.
Do you want to explain that piece we just supposedly heard?
Tobabo Fonio for trombone propelled electronics. Well, let me read a bit about
trombone propeller and electronics.
Tobabo Fonio is a reconstruction of recorded brass band music from the Peruvian Andes, imposing upon that music the kind of structural adaptations and cultural misunderstandings that accompanied its own diversionary course from Europe. The sounds are processed through my, meaning Nick Collins's, trombone-propelled electronics, a digital signal processor that is controlled from the movements of a trombone slide and uses the brass instrument as an acoustically malleable loudspeaker. The initial samples are so short that they are heard as only as the resonant drones of stolen waveforms sprayed around the room by the... Oh, my goodness, sprayed around the room.
We will discuss that later.
This is how it must be a trombone if it's spraying around the room. Where were we? sprayed around the room by the highly directional trombone speaker.
Objectionable.
Too many B's in that. Directionable, trombonable, speakable. The pitch of the drone deepens as the samples are lengthened. This texture gives way to bursts of trumpet riffs and drum rolls, and finally brief glimpses of its core of Kazuchenya music. The original recording is by the group Primavera de Talca.
Wow.
So, yeah, Tobabo Fonio by Nick Collins, our guest today. Let's play more Nick Collins. Let's do a little bit more. Nick Collins... an oddish duck. I'm sure you'll, before we do the interview, give a little bit more description of our encounter with...
Your encounter, my illness.
Illness with Nick. Well, in interesting sort, he'll tell you all about himself. He's very pleased to tell you about himself. I suspect that's one of the main occupations of his life, is telling people about himself.
So we don't have to. But
right.
It would be redundant, but that's us anyway.
It's true enough. Let's play a little bit. This is a CD that Tobabo Fonio is from, a CD called It Was a Dark and Stormy Night. I hate it when people steal that good line.
Right.
Ah, darn it. It Was a Dark and Stormy Night is the name of the CD, and has a rather good piece called It Was a Dark and Stormy Night on it. And actually, that's a darn good piece, and I'd really like to play it. We may actually play it during the show, but let's play a little piece called Broken Light, the first movement. Now, one of the things that old Nick Collins did was to use the capacities of certain day-to-day consumer electronics for rather unusual purposes. And one of the things that you'll notice about CD players that get stuck is that every once in a while they'll start repeating sections in a certain pattern, as if the thing were stuck. Unlike the old days of the LP, where it did that, the rotational speed of the CD changes as it goes from the inside to the outside. So when it's toward the inside of the disc, which is where it starts, the rotational speed is considerably faster than the outside, which goes slower when it gets there. You see what I mean?
What?
Anyway, so Nick takes advantage of this feature, as it were, this failure of CDs to create a piece. Now, he doesn't explain it, so it gives me a chance to do that. Anyway, this is the Soldier String Quartet with Broken Light by Nick Collins, using those wonderful... Thank you. dandy music there. That's music by Nick Collins. That's the first section of his tune, Broken Light. That one is called Corelli. And then the second movement is Locatelli, and the third movement is Torelli. What do you think of that, eh? Oh, there we are. There's your switch.
It all sounds like an Italian menu to me, but it's all nice and chopped. I like it.
That's right. You know, and because it's an Italian menu, since it sounds like that, I have this thing called the Tosca salad.
Hey, very, very nice.
Pauline Oliveros, who was a guest a few weeks ago, left us with a CD, and I think we should take the other side of where some of the new stuff is going. This, you know, Stuart Dempster was interviewed on
our show,
National Public Radio, 2 weeks ago, and so was Pauline Oliveros. And for those of you who managed to hear that show and not our live performance with Pauline, let's do a little bit of Stuart Dempster here. We have a duet with Pauline Oliveros and Stuart Dempster from their CD Tosca Salad. Here it is. Somewhere. Pauline Oliveros and Stuart Dempster in a duet from Tosca Salad.
Which duet was this?
The Dempster-Oliveros duet.
Ah, yes.
From the Deep Listening Band.
Right.
That CD available from the Deep Listening website, which you can look up by typing in Deep Listening and find it on your searcher. Nice folks, these guys here in this Deep Listening Band.
Anyone who supplies us with free playables... or donates some kind of food to us.
True enough.
Nice guy.
Speaking of donations, we have to talk about this. We have to be serious now for a moment because at WGDR we have had a technical dilemma, which is an expensive technical dilemma. And the transmitter that brings these happy signals and our ever so non-scornful parody of ourselves
oh, that.
To you has suffered a bit.
We didn't do it.
I know we didn't do it, but we got to...
thought you were getting ready to apologize.
Anyway, we need to help with the repairs of the transmitter. We have had some transmitting tubes blow out, unlike the old radio tubes, for those of you old enough to remember, like us, the wondrous warmth of radio tubes. The transmitting tubes are bigger, much more expensive, handmade things, and they chew up lots of power, and in the process, once in a while, self-destruct. Well, we've had several self-destructions in the past week, which means we have a major tab in the thousands of dollars to pay to keep the station on the air.
So if any of you have transmitter tubes, we would be happy to take them off your hands.
We'd love some transmitter tubes. If, on the other hand, you don't have transmitter tubes but do have some spare... not even spare, but some cash you can afford to provide to WGDR to keep those transmitter tubes there, we'd very much appreciate it. You can write to us, send a check to Box 336 Plainfield, or you can call us right now at 454-7762. We'd very much appreciate a donation. Any amount would be appreciated, but a major donation would be even more appreciated. To purchase a transmitter tube, you could pledge right now an amount of $1,000, which will buy one tube. Thanks very much, but really, $1,000 will buy one transmitter tube. We got to replace two of them. So your... and plus the spares, which also blew out. So we have to raise $4,000, like, soon. So please give us a call, 454-7762, here at WGDR Plainfield, where you're listening to the Calvus and Damien New Music Sesquibazaar.
And don't limit yourself to checks, small bundles of cash in preferably non-sequential numbered format. Would be appreciated as well.
And pretty much in any currency.
Yeah,
in the lira,
yes.
We'd have to be talking about millions. In zlotys, we'd have to be talking about hundreds of millions. And in English pounds, so 600, 700 of those wouldn't be a problem at all.
Do we have those around? Are there poundages of currencies that... yes, the weight of the currency is also...
true enough. Yes, the weight is. Well, speaking of lira and Corelli and Vivaldi and who did I say? Corelli and...
Tocca salad.
And Tosca salad, that's right. We have one more here. We have from Italian composer Boris Porena, who was born in 1927. We have a 1988 piece called Vivaldi. We hope you will get a smile on the face for this, because we don't play such wonderfully accessible music so often, and pull out the old checkbook or bundles of cash. Call us right now at 454-7762 while we listen to the first movement of a piece called Vivaldi by Boris Porena.
Thank you.
A great piece to test the alignment of your stereo system.
Jolly music from 1988 by Italian composer Boris Parena. It gets a little bit more off track as it gets further in the other two movements. That's Vivaldi by Boris Parena. From a great CD called Italian Compositions of the 20th Century, including two film composers, Nino Rota and Ennio Morricone, and also Gian Francesco Marfiera. So,
That's bueno. I like that. Fine.
That's good. Shall we turn to our interview with Nick Collins?
Right.
Preface, please.
Preface. There were two people supposedly conducting this interview. One of these two persons was, shall we say, afflicted with some very heavy-duty Teutonic germs and was, I think you put it best in your travelogue, nasally soaking a towel.
A green towel
a
already.
A green towel, and there was just no end to the degree of...
It's sufficiently between lunch and dinner to describe how utterly disgusting these moments were. But Nick brought us a lovely cup of tea and some munchies, cookie munchies.
Yes, yes.
And out of my left peripheral vision, I noticed the cookie munchies disappearing into one orifice and sort of liquid matter appearing out of another orifice onto this green towel during the entire course of the interview.
I thought I was... trying to be a bit discreet by keeping the nasally soaked green towel up to the edge of the room and getting up to soak it and not doing it right in front of the microphone.
Well, maybe not, but, you know, it was green after all, and it was a very bright color so that each time you sort of went up there to... you know the old 1950s black and white films of the steam engines that pull up to where the water...
The vision is well thought out. Yes.
You trundled across the room like the engine toward the green towel. Or actually, the green towel was more like the engine because it was sort of sitting on top of your backpack and whatever that was you were carrying and sort of unloaded on it. And then you came back and had a bit more tea and another cracker or two.
Yes. That was the extent of my participation in this afternoon's work.
Well, as you can hear when we listen to the interview, the other interviewer was beginning to become afflicted with the same germs, and my voice was quite a bit huskier than I recall it.
Of course, that could be just the radio.
Could have been. This is an extended interview. We'll have to break this over 2 weeks, maybe three. I hope not three, but... Nick has lots to say.
Isn't there a speed control? Could you just boost the speed a bit?
Maybe we should play it the same way that he played the CDs to produce the...
Of course. Sample fast.
I think not. Let's play the whole thing. Shall we?
All right.
Well, let's just see what happens. This is recorded at a rather low level, so I hope we can crank it up enough to be heard. Across the ocean we go.
Bitter. Not indoors.
Not indoors.
No, indoors it has not at all. It's the tea is warm, the child is happy, and it's much better than the wind. We're at the flat of Nick Collins, Amsterdam. Yes. And it's the 77th episode of the Calvos and Damien New Music Sesquiarra.
You know what? I think I'm going to interrupt this and see if we can put this.
Are you
on
tired of this already?
Another CD player that will play it maybe a bit louder because boy, that level is way down there. Let's just see how this sounds.
Your timing is perfect.
Ah, that's much better. So we'll just back up to the beginning of that interview because we don't want to miss a word.
We heard it already, though. That's what he was doing.
How was that? Back again.
It's turned bitter.
Not indoors.
Not indoors. No, indoors it has not at all. The tea is warm. The child is happy, and it's much better than the wind. We're at the flat of Nick Collins in Amsterdam. Yes, and it's the 77th episode of the Calvos and Damien New Music Sesquiar. Welcome.
Thank you. Your timing is perfect because you've arrived on March 26th, which, as musical cognoscenti know, is the birthday of three musical luminaries of this century.
Luminaries.
Diana Ross, Pierre Boulez, and Nick Collins.
Ooh.
So there you go. Perfect timing.
Birthday celebration.
A birthday celebration, yes. Well, maybe we'll run this next March 23rd. No. So we're here, and we're going to say we're running kind of auditorially blind. Mm. So we're going to ask you to introduce yourself as if you were making a pitch as a mature composer for the first time, saying, here's my stuff. I want you to understand what I do and love what I do.
I'm old, I'm hungry, I have a family to feed. Buy my records.
Sorry, try again.
Well, I'm older today than I was yesterday. Okay. By way of background, I suppose we might as well begin there. I was a student of Alvin Lucier's at Wesleyan University, and I worked for many years with David Tudor's group, Composers Inside Electronics. A lot of my own interest as a composer can be traced immediately to those two influences. From Lucier, I developed my aesthetic, one might say, which comes out of a kind of a minimalist cant, and I do pieces that tend to be rather simple. I work a lot with acoustical phenomena, one way or the other, in pieces. But I'm also of that generation of American composers who learned to make circuits because we were at that threshold period where the technology was available, but it was available at a very high price in terms of that which you could buy, synthesizer equipment. And it was before MIDI, it was before standardization. We were sort of wandering in the wilderness and coming up with all sorts of idiosyncratic ways of making noise. And, of course, Tudor was a great influence to a number of people, as I say, of my generation, people like Paul DeMarinis or John Bischoff, the West Coast composers associated around Mills College. The other sort of strong influence, though I never was a student of his, is Christian Wolff. And from the early days of doing electronic pieces, I was always interested in these ideas of social cooperation between players and using circuits as a way to coordinate player activities. I used to look at those Christian Wolff scores from the early 60s, like for one, two, or three players, and they looked to me like diagrams of logic states and logic algorithms in terms of, you know, binary processes. You know, if this happens and this happens, then this should happen.
Right.
And my 20-year unrealized project is to actually do a computer version of some of those scores so that, you know, two people would plug into it and out would come a Christian Wolff piece. He seems vaguely interested in it, but I think we're all just as happy the world has not seen that or heard it yet. And I was born in Manhattan, and I returned to Manhattan after being a student, spending a year in Europe with the Thomas Watson Fellowship, and then living on the West Coast for a year. So basically, I've been New York based for most of my life, and I moved over here in '92 to Amsterdam to become the co-director of a foundation called STIME,
right.
Which is a sort of a music research institute. I call it EARCOM with a human face. It's sort of a much, much scruffier approach,
right,
to some similar problems about using technology in live performance. The emphasis at STIME has always been live performance and keeping things as cheap and portable as possible. It's sort of for the working musician, person who has to get on and off trains with suitcases of equipment rather than watch the roadies take the semi down the road,
right,
while you go up in the helicopter.
Let me start with a question about the area, the gray area between someone dragging around a keyboard or a guitar and the area in which you begin to use computers in what starts to be an autonomous way, where they have they've been given sets of instructions, or you've had circuits working, but they have a kind of a life of their own.
Mm.
There is a strong sense in many of a general listening audience that something happens at that point that makes it hard to get at what's going on.
Well, actually, I think that's a relic of a slightly earlier era, the crossover point making it difficult for an audience. Rich Gold, who is a composer and one of the sort of the profound thinkers of modern musical technological aesthetics, he coined an expression, ubiquitous computing, for his vision of what was happening in the late 80s and early 90s in terms of computers basically being everywhere. You know, they're in the phone, they're in the answering machine, they're in your teacup, you know. And this is something that's been echoed a lot in the industry. Mitch Kapor from Lotus also, you know, once predicted that the next market for the computer, this was in the mid-80s, was going to be the telephone, which, of course, you know, predicted the flourishing of the internet culture and everything else, that it would become a communication tool rather than a data tool. So it's clear that the technology is infiltrating everywhere. I mean, the moniker of electronic music, which had some significance at the time that I started doing it, has none really at the moment, because, I mean, it's a cliche, but the electronics are everywhere. I mean, from, you know, from editing an aria to, you know, any pop band. And again, it's a cliche, but the lead-lag relationship between the so-called avant-garde and the commercial or popular music has shifted clearly in the last 10 years. Where it used to be that the so-called avant-garde was at the cutting edge of sound design, technological innovation, everything else. And now it tends to be the other way around. In other words, the muscle and money for research and development of music technology is clearly lies in the commercial sector now, not in academic or independent music. So a lot of the sounds and techniques and algorithms, to use the fuzzy computer music journal, you know, view, are actually being broken by, you know, low-level, street-oriented, you know, dance production, rather than at Stanford or someplace like that.
I guess the question I'm asking is more toward, if you set in motion processes rather than direct them at the shall we say the organ stop level, the
right,
is there something that has changed there that makes it a little bit
clearly, I mean, the technology you know, flourishes at a number of different levels, and the most sort of visible or audible level is clearly one of sound design. I mean, that's where the average person is most aware of it. At the same time, all of the, you know, what I maintained when I started working with microcomputers in 1978 or 79 is that the great advantage of them over a, say, if one can use this term, a traditional electronic music circuit, is that the computer has memory.
Right.
And the computer can make certain types of decisions, where electronic circuits analog circuits tended to have a kind of an instantaneous property to them in terms of their behavior, that they did not have intrinsically a time-varying structure to them, right? Computers, this was the natural thing. Well, in this, clearly, you know, you take the interest in Tudor and the interest in Wolfe, and you get, you know, fertile ground for a young dweeb like myself to fabricate a new musical stream based on the confluence of the sonic palette of Tudor and the say, organizational ideas of Christian Wolfe. Perhaps I was blindsided because the development of MIDI sequencers and algorithmic compositional tools in the 80s were clearly along somewhat similar lines in terms of what do you harness from the computer's energy.
That's right.
So the fact of the matter is that dance music production is completely dependent on sequencer technology mm-hmm. and on digital editing capabilities, which are you know a little bit more invisible. Now, the main distinction I think between commercial, say, pop music and let's just call it experimental music, for want of a better term, is the element of risk and chance. That, you know, at least in the United States and with expats and emigres to Europe or Europeans who have sort of immersed themselves in American culture, you know, the legacy of Cage is pretty nefarious and far-reaching. But chance is one of the most profound lessons we've learned from him, you know, which is how do you incorporate this in your work? There are many different ways in which you can do it. When there's a lot of money resting on every sound you put down in a studio that's ticking off at $160 an hour,
right.
Sometimes you're not so interested in chance. Mm-hmm. And I think that commercial pop music is basically about control. I mean, there are areas of improvisation, clearly, but I don't think machines are allowed to run amok as often in commercial music as they are in experimental music. And this is a nice broad generality for someone now to call up the station and shoot me down on. But I think that, you know, I feel reasonably safe from my relatively myopic standpoint of drawing that conclusion. Now, in terms of what it means for the audience, is that I feel that audiences are getting more receptive to more variation and more stylistic experimentation than they were when I started out, for example. And, you know, one can look at a few either indications of this or, you know, examples of traces of where you might see this, yeah? That on the one hand, you have a rate of change in pop stylism that is, if not accelerating, has certainly gone up several plateaus over the last 10 years. The without actually being faddism, per se. I mean, you get, like in dance music, you get a much more rapid change. I mean, if you think about how long, say, in our childhood, the Motown R&B aesthetic held sway over the dance floor versus, say, the number of crazes we've been through since mid-70s disco. And there's a lot of money changing hands in this area, too. It has also established itself as a very definite stream, apart from pop, for want of a better term. I mean, you get diversity and you get a rapid rate of change. And obviously, this cannot be artist-driven entirely. Obviously, this is market-driven to some degree. And what it indicates is that either there is an incredible specialization in the market, or... Hang on, can we just pause for a second while I get the phone? This is real life.
Market-driven.
And I wondered if you could sort of mix that in with a consideration that maybe we have a little stylistically, a little musical, maybe entropy happening here.
Are we rolling?
Yes, we
are. Oh, we are. Good Lord, there's no such thing as privacy. Yeah. So what I was going to say is that I think it's market-driven. That clearly artists make decisions in this, but these records don't sell if they don't sell, right? And the second thing is if you look at the increasing interest in non let's say, non-Western pop music. In other words, I think that the market for so-called world music has grown tremendously in the last, say, 8 years. And there was an early wave in the 70s. I mean, when I went to Wesleyan, it was a hotspot for ethnomusicology and for, you know, world music wannabes. You know, percussionists in particular from numerous pop bands would be studying briefly with Indian and African drummers at Wesleyan to try to get a little of that under their belt. Steve Reich and Phil Glass were, you know, sort of coming into prominence, and they had definite connections to that culture. But the world music thing has obviously taken a big pump in the late 80s and early 90s. Well, people are listening to it with a degree of intelligence and breadth of style that they certainly didn't in the early days of the post, you know, Norwegian wood, you know, sitar revolution. So, you know, there's a proliferation of styles. And what I think it means is that, to get back to your point a long time ago, where there's perhaps a schism with the audience where they suddenly say, ooh, technology's in here, you know, let's question what's going on. I would have to say that I don't find that to be the case when I tour and perform and put out records these days. I do not see as many reviews that just simply dismiss an artist for being off the wall compared to what happened 15 years ago. And perhaps it's a nice antidote to the Jesse Helms of this world that, in fact, the public is becoming more culturally aware, even while the politicians are, you know, essentially going in the opposite direction.
Let's point this at a piece of yours. Maybe we can look, listen to something that will illuminate that.
Well, I don't know if that's I don't know if that works, because in other words, you know, that being said and done, all I can say is that as a composer, all I can do is do what I do. Mm-hmm. It sounds like you know, one of the great insights of all time. But the fact is that I do what I do and have continued to follow my own, you know, peculiar obsessions for a long time now, you know, basically about 20 years of performing publicly and recording. And observations such as the ones I just spouted are just that. They're observations of, oh, you know, yeah, I guess a little bit does change now and then. But I can't ever say that it has directly influenced what I do. In other words,
I guess I'm not asking influenced what you do, but rather is there a piece we can hear that, in fact, was not, shall we say, dismissed by the reviewers and was received by the audience with enthusiasm that employs technological means that are somewhat at the surface?
Well, I can point to a couple of examples that actually, probably, if anything, satisfy better the rubric of a little too soon. You know,
okay, let's do that, sure.
Which tends to be what goes on. When I did my first record for Lovely Music, which was, I think, in 1980, and I'm horribly bad on dates, I did a piece called Is She, He Really Going Out With Him, Her, Them? And this was the first wave. This was the time of the first wave of disc jockey virtuosos in New York, and there was a guy named Grandmaster Flash in particular who did very beautiful virtuosic cueing, slip cueing from cut to cut to cut. And it was this obsession of the time of, you know, making these mellifluous transitions between materials. And in fact, there would be DJ competitions where DJ would be given, you know, 2 minutes, and was the winner was whoever managed to slip in the most records in that period of time. And of course, the more difficult it was for anyone to keep count, the better off you were on style points. But this piece that I did, which was sort of inspired by that use of the record player as an instrument, was based on a typical avant-garde obsession of, well, if two turntables sound good, you know, what would 20 sound like? And the idea was, I made a small automated mixer, you know, sort of the world's most budget SSL. And each channel of the mixer had a circuit in it that looked for the rhythm of the sound material coming through. And the idea was that you had a 16-channel mixer, and the mixer would cut back and forth between different channels whenever they were on beat. You know, it's just like a DJ does. But it was obviously factorially more dense in terms of permutations, because you might get seven or eight different things intercutting at the same time. And yet what it had that very odd psychological property of the mix was always changing, but you could never put your finger on when or how it changed, because essentially it tried to synchronize unsynchronizable material. Because, again, you know, me being sort of a malcontent, I didn't put in 16 dance tracks of vaguely different beats per minute, but I put in, you know, completely unrelated material, sound effects, little electronic toys, tape loops, live radio, somebody playing guitar, I mean, you know, and it would just sort of try to make things seamless. And it was nice. Performing it, you would sort of come up with different material for every performance, and it was a little like satisfying the appetite of some horrible monster, because it was there, and you just had to keep plugging and unplugging things to keep the texture going. So, you know, this was sort of, I thought, was right in the pocket for the developments in music at the time, but I gather that the buying public for lovely music in that year was not exactly identical to that of South Bronx hip-hop, you know, record shops. Well, this is pre-hip-hop, but whatever.
But if you go a few years...
Go a few years later, like 1985, I think I put out this record called Devil's Music. And now this one's an interesting case in point at this time in history, because Devil's Music was a piece that was based on using live radio transmissions and sampling them in real time with some very crude sampling devices. They were basically small boxes made by Electro-Harmonix at the time that would let me sample a couple of seconds of sound and then loop it and re-trigger it, so that you could get that sort of stuttering, big dog.
That became actually kind of a popular
thing.
Definitely.
For a while.
Everybody was doing it, and now it's gone beyond cliche. It's almost a period identifier.
Yes, it's like Bach.
Yeah.
But in this case, I had the setup worked that I had a number of these small samples. I think it was about three. And I would load in something off the radio by listening and scanning through the radio dial with a scanning radio. And then when I thought I had something good, boom, it would go in. And it would make a loop. But the loop was always being re-triggered by whatever was coming out of the radio at the time. So you had the rhythm of the original material and then whatever was unheard by everyone but me re-triggering it. So it had this sort of stuttering quality. It was probably one of the saving points in my life. And then I could load up the three samples with different loops, to make a sort of polyphony. Or I could transfer the loops from one to the next to the next. So you would get this sort of multi-voice variations, these sort of dense iterations of one material, which would sort of be like, say, taking a random walk through the tape material of like the Steve Reich phase pieces. In other words, you could have two of these delays of the same material going against each other, but they would never not make this nice phase cycle. They would be jumping from one position to another. Well, I performed this piece hundreds of times, literally around the world, and my image was that of the sort of the wandering minstrel. You know, that you come to town and you go to the market and you find out the dirt about, you know, who's sleeping with whom. You know, the king has a bit on the side and the queen is drinking too much and this and that. And then you set yourself up on Sunday afternoon in the square, and you start to sing these songs, and everyone says, oh, nice, you know, another minstrel. And then you say, oh, and the king, he has a Welsh rarebit, and, you know, it smells of cheese all day. And they say, ooh, that's about our king. How did he know about our king? You know, where did he get all this inside dirt? Well, when I would do this piece on the road, it would be, you know, little music, little talk, little this, little that, and then suddenly it would be like a local sporting event. People would say, you know, I don't get it, even though everything was there in front of them, the radio, you know. But they still didn't believe it was live. I mean, you know, this... And then it got to have a nice, cozy quality as soon as people realized, oh, you know, that's one of my local DJs. I hate him. You know, oh, that's the weather. The weather, what is it going to do tonight? Oh, you missed that. You just was about to say it was going to snow or rain. Come on, can you go back? Was this sort of wandering through the radio landscape everywhere I went, and it was quite nice because it would change character. I'd do it in Hungary, and people would say, oh, you know, you made a very funny pun in Hungarian when you took this newscaster in one loop and a weather girl in the other, and it made it sound like socialism was raining. Socialism was raining, you know, it's a pun. Where did you know so much Hungarian? You know, I said, well, chance.
Oh, 10,000 you know, monkeys and
10,000 monkeys and Nick.
Nick.
But the point is that it was a very nice road piece. It had a very nice extemporaneous quality. And when I went to do a recording, I tried to think about, well, how should I, you know, I can't just take one good performance and put it down. I should really think about it. So I made a record that one side was basically a dance record where I did a multi-track version where I just ran through late night New York sampling dance stations. Wonderful, infectious, rhythmic stuff. And then I did vocal lines by taking commercials, sound bites from commercials, ham radio communication, and some cellular stuff, some you know, phone calls. And then for the B side, one of the materials that... And by the way, what was nice about doing the dance stuff is that the rhythmic, that kind of rhythmic intensity of the regular dance groove would be all kind of twisted by this re-triggering. Mm-hmm. It got to be very, very sort of complicated cross rhythms, but basically keeping this funky feel.
But you felt, I was going to say.
It was somewhere in there. Robert Paus used to say it was like an intro that never settled into a groove, you know.
That's good.
And it did it for 20 minutes, which is probably too irritating for most people, but I'll get back to that. And the B-side, I discovered in the course of all these performances that what worked, certain types of sound material worked much better in this system than others. And dance stuff was great, and speech was wonderful always. I mean, the sort of the cut up of speech, it was like instant Kurt Schwitters or something. And then I'll bet that's for Carla. And then the mainstream pop. ¶¶ Mainstream pop, for some reason, always fell flat through the system. If like the Rolling Stones came on and went through it, it just sounded like everything our parents told us, you know, about pop. I don't know. It all sounds the same to me. But what worked beautifully was easy listening music. It was something about the richness of having a real string section instead of a string synthesizer, and you know, like real brass, and yet compared to classical music, you know, the part divisions in easy listening, the arrangements tend to be very clear one way or the other. It's like it's either strings or it's winds or it's brass. So there was a little clearer than actual classical. So-called
something
classical music.
Also compresses nicely in the supermarket and such, so make it clear, yeah.
And so those were the two things. So the B-side of the record was an easy listening record. It was just samples of easy listening. And it has a wonderful sort of, Phil Glass on Quaaludes quality to it, or a little bit like some of the early Terry Riley pieces. And I was always very straightforward about, there was a very definite debt to those, the phase music of the 70s, the Reich pieces, some of the Glass, simple keyboard music. So in any case, this is hopelessly long, but cut. And I made this record, and I thought, finally, after how many, you know, 10 years in the business, this is a record that everyone will buy. Everyone will buy it, because between dance music and easy listening, I've got 75% of the buying public of America sewn up, right? And it was a great comeuppance to realize that, you know, these were very tight genres and I had strayed a bit too far, and not everyone in America was going to buy it. I took it to a few DJ record shops in New York, because one of my ideas was that on the dance side of the record there must have been, conservatively 150 samples, 200 samples of different material on it. And I thought, at that time people had these breakbeats collections where there'd be a disc of just a lot of rhythm breaks that they'd throw in like as an accent on top of a dance record or to fill between one and another. And I thought, this is like an encyclopedia of breakbeats. You can just go through it and pick and put a piece of masking tape on saying, this is 2 seconds that's perfect. And in 20 minutes you have a lot of perfect 2 seconds. So my feeling was that with the proper marketing, every DJ would buy it for a few hits here and there. And a couple of dance stores took a couple of copies, but basically it didn't move. Yeah, so now the piece is sort of out of repertoire. I'm on to other things. You know, we've sold a couple thousand of the records, and the rest are sitting in my attic. I'm not thinking about it too much. I'm on to the next project. And, you know, like 5 years later, these rumors start filtering back. This guy says, I was in an acid house club in Berlin, and they were playing devil's music. And I said, it's interesting. And I get these little tricklebacks from DJ flea markets, record swaps, where this record is changing hands for $30, you know, $40. Considering I was selling it for $5 out of the suitcase when I was touring, I felt, you know, great, more power to them. But I got 800 in my attic. You know, just call the record company and they'll send them to you. You know, I mean, Christ, I'm not doing me any good. And, you know, so first it was the acid house thing, and the DJs were buying. And then, like in the last, what, 2-3 years, easy listening has become like a big thing again. You know, you read that elevator music book, you see their easy listening clubs in New York now, London, it's a big, big thing. They're reissuing all of the old, you know, space age music for the bachelor pad on CD. Burt Bacharach is a god. You know, he's replaced Darius Milhaud as the principal element of that relationship. Tyro Tutor usurpation. And then there's this young guy, Scanner, in the UK, who's, you know, gone back to the same idea of taking live radio in live performance. He takes a scanner that's picking up phone calls, you know, and he just puts it on the table and lets it ride and, you know, puts a kind of a techno or ambient beat under it, according to the situation. Wow. So, you know...
Take the record.
Oh, you know, it's now what, basically 10 years after the fact, it's in the pocket, and he's you know, doing quite well by it. And there maybe is hope for my 800 LPs. Of any of that kind of thing.
Well, you said
maybe it's 799 ones, since you must be playing it. You see, if you do this interview, you have to play it, so you've got to get one.
Absolutely. You said earlier that you used self-descriptive terms, malcontent and irritating, and a few things like that. Does your early earliness in producing some of these ideas result in irritation, or is it a result of you?
You mean, am I twisted and bitter?
Yeah, are you twisted?
I've always been
bitter?
Twisted.
Yeah, okay.
No, I don't know. I'll have to say that you know, I always go on record saying this, and I think people must think I have incredible delusions, but I think of my music as being extremely conservative. And very unadventurous, rather timid music. I tend to do small form works. I mean, I've done some ensemble pieces, but a lot of it is solo performer or two performers. It tends to have a very thin texture. I usually make what is basically kind of a monophonic music. I mean, I think it's a music that grows out of being a solo performer. Perhaps in one's youth on an instrument, and then in this sort of composer-performer tradition of American experimental music, just the idea of, well, look, I only got two hands, you know, what do you expect out of me? If you can get the counterpoint of a Bach cello piece, you know, you're lucky. It tends to be ephemeral. It sort of does something to you while you're listening to it, but it's not like you leave humming a tune or
right.
saying, what a powerful
right.
message. And I think that I've never tried to push it, what I do, in any particular direction that would say, possibly lead me to a crossover audience in an intentional way.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? In other words, that when I was doing the Devil's Music, it was clear to me all along that with a little tightening up of the thing and, say, overlaying the stuttering of the parts against a good solid loop, I might be able to play more into the hands of the dominant musical ideology of the day. But it just wasn't interesting to me. I'm not independently wealthy, so clearly the possibility of having 100,000 selling record is not something I would spurn, and I'm not prissy about what I do, but it just didn't interest me. And I also have always felt I have a terrible self-image, and I've always felt that there are only a few things that I do well, and I'm very hesitant to try to do something that I don't do well. And I have immense respect for pop songwriters and pop producers and their ability to craft in that idiom. I have been listening to it since my childhood, and I can say that's good and that's not, and that's what I like and that's what I'm not, but I would be woefully inadequate at trying to produce as in write the music for a piece of pop music. I would not be able to compose the fetchy drum pattern that would make the difference between yay or nay. That being said, I did in the 80s spend some time producing pop records for other groups, but I think in many cases it was the death knell of their career, even though it garnered them good press in the more avant-garde circles. It certainly didn't help land them on the desk of Warner Elektra.
Well, when you say you're incapable of it, are you really, or is the incapability driven by a different kind of a vision or a lack of desire to do what is in some ways contemporaneous rather than looking ahead? Are you race ahead of yourself, in other words, and say, I don't have time to do that?
No, actually, I have never been interested in sort of the predictive quality of what I do in others. I don't sit there and say, oh, you know, I'm doing this with these materials, The same materials are being used by this band down the street, but I'm miles ahead of them. I mean, I'm doing what they'll be doing in 4 years, if they're lucky.
I don't think that's not the issue. Whether it's a conscious drive, but rather you find yourself doing it and saying, how did I get here? You know, you don't sit back and reflect and say, oh, yes, I don't want to do that because it's being done. But rather, you tumble past it.
I think that it's, for example, work very slowly. You know, different composers and different musicians work at different rates. And for example, when I was living in New York, Elliot Sharp was a good friend of mine. We did a number of projects and tours together, and I was always amazed at the speed with which he produced stuff. He seemed to be putting out a record every week, and you know, he had all these different projects going on. You know, he had this group, he had the solo thing. He was working with the computer here, he was working with the string quartet here, blah blah blah. And I just, like, it dazzled me because, you know, I produce stuff very slowly. I don't know that there's, I can put my finger on anything. I mean, computer programming is tedious. Building circuitry is tedious. But at the same time, I think I have very few ideas. I work within a very small number of ideas, and I'm essentially poking at the boundaries of a set, and looking to either see, well, what is the variations within it that I have not explored yet, or where is there, like, a little breakthrough point into the next step.
Thank you.
You could just go out the door humming those melodies over and over.
Indeed. We'll conclude our interview with Nick Collins next week.
What, he has more to say? I don't recall that he said anything else. I thought he drifted off after that. Or was it me?
One of us drifted off. Maybe two out of three drifted off. But Nick, no. Nick was on the whole time. Ah. You're listening to the Calvos and Damien New Music Bazak Sui Square here on the WGDR Tube Needing Station, Plainfield. Give us a call or write us, please, 454-7762. We really have an economic crisis with the need for our new transmitter tubes to replace the ones that are rapidly burning up, probably because of some of the music we're playing here.
Not us.
Not us, all right.
We play soft, easy music.
And we're about to play Nick Collins' piece, It Was a Dark and Stormy Night. And this is a 27-minute long piece, and we're going to play the whole thing. It's unusual. We don't play anything quite that long, but, what can I say?
What can you say? Nothing. Just explain the piece, maybe. you might mention that one of the performers has agreed not to be on our program.
Yes. David Moss, the voice in this, has definitely not agreed to... It's not agreeable, or something about agreement in our program. It might have been the price, but in any case, we'll be listening to the Soldier String Quartet, plus Tom Cora cello, Rob Bethy trombone, Bob Neal trumpet, Guy Kluchevsky, I can't even say these names today, Kluchevsky accordion, and Robert Poss, who's in Band of Susans, playing on electric
Band
guitar.
Band of Susans?
Yes, it might be. I'm not sure we'll ever play Band of Susans on this particular show, but we played drearier music, more boring music than Band of Susans. Hard to sort of remember when that happened, but...
I brought it in. I brought in Art Zoid.
Art Zoid. No, this takes the prize from Art Zoid.
Oh, dear.
I think this is the Art Zoid on Quaaludes that you were looking for. Anyway, we're going to listen to the entirety of It Was a Dark and Stormy Night. Arrangement and development by Nick Collins. That's Nick without an H, by the way, N-I-C-O-L-A-S. He's very proud of that. And excerpts on the textual heroes by Sarah Caldwell, by Peter Dickinson, and who else is on it? E.M. Forster and John Hillerby.
Jasper Johns, wasn't that one?
Dorothy Fleming and that's Dorothy Sayers, actually, Dorothy Sayers Fleming. I think that's all. And Peter Virgo. So we're here. Excerpts from those as arranged, reorganized, redisposed, disposed.
Acoustically enhanced?
Enhanced indeed acoustically and underplayed by Nick Collins and his ensemble of people. It was a dark and stormy night. In the meantime, we expect the phones to ring off the hook at 454-7762 to help us with our transmitter tube dilemma. It was a dark and stormy night. Music by Nick Collins.
It was a dark and stormy night. We were all sitting around the campfire. I turned to Ben and said, "Ben, tell us a story." And Ben proceeded as follows. It was a dark, dark, stormy night. We were all seated around the campfire. I turned to Robert and said, "Robert, tell us a story." And Robert proceeded as follows. It was a rainy night in Georgia. Round about midnight, we were all hunkered down by the campfire, drying our feet. I looked up at Guy and said, "Guy, tell us a story." And Guy started up. It was cold and wet that night. We were all shivering miserably around the campfire. I called over to Mary. "Mary, tell us a story." Mary shook the water out of her ear and proceeded as follows. It was a painfully cold, moonless night, crystal clear, beautiful. We sat in a circle around the campfire. making s'mores. I got up, walked once round the fire, crouched down, and whispered into Susan's ear. Susan, tell us a story. A mystery story. And Susan commenced. In 1945 in Amsterdam, just after the war, Han van Meegeren was arrested and accused of having sold a Dutch national treasure, namely Vermeer's Christ and the Adulteress, to the Germans, namely Goering. It was the kind of thing that was happening all over Europe. Citizens of formerly occupied countries were being charged with trying to profit from the war at the expense of their own nation. And seemingly they had van Meegeren dead to rights. He had certainly sold the painting. It had clearly been bought by Goering. And there is no question that a painting by Vermeer, any painting by Vermeer, is a national treasure. So everyone was taken more or less by surprise by van Meegeren's defense that he was not a traitor, but a national hero, because the painting was not a Vermeer at all, but a van Meegeren, that he had painted it himself. No one, of course, believed him at first. The examination of the painting revealed that it was clearly by the same hand as the Summer at the Mouse, Museum of Romance in Rotterdam. A painting from the same period of Vermeer's work, a painting well accepted and authenticated by no less a personage than the great Dutch art historian, Brelius. Van Meegeren was insistent, however, and eventually the authorities allowed him to try to prove his point by painting yet another Vermeer in his prison cell, which he did. The new painting was obviously from the same hand as the Goering painting and the Bloemhof painting, and the Head of Christ in Last Supper belonging to von Bohlen, and Isaac Ludwig Jacob in the collection of von Bohlen, as well as the Rijksmuseum's The Russian Palace of Speed. In fact, it soon appeared that virtually every Vermeer to have come onto the market in the 20th century was in reality von Meegeren. Treason charges were dropped, and forgery charges were brought. But van Meegeren died before the trial could take place. The funny thing is that the van Meegeren paintings are all very ugly, and look nothing like what one thinks of when one thinks of Vermeer. Another funny thing is that the same is true of a handful of accepted Vermeers. One thinks of the lion as the imprisoned, always coming from the left, the air of the sea. In fact, it's more like a dark and stormy night. We were all sitting around the campfire. Han turned to John and said, John, tell us a story. And John proceeded as follows. Do you remember the 60s? That's when I decided to walk across Africa. Now this story takes place in Kenya. Wrapped up in three cotton vests at the bottom of my pack, I kept a little wireless set, made in Japan and extraordinarily efficient at picking up three, and almost only three, types of music. Europe and North America seemed to transmit almost nothing but rock and roll, augmented by peculiarly British early morning and workers' playtime type of bands. Whatever the repertoire of the Dumpty Dumpty Dickies were delivered at exactly the same tempo, encore at encore ad nauseam. A twist of the dial brought in the wail of Islam. Costive and insistent in North Africa, but enriched in the Sudan by full-throated recitations from the Quran. From Nairobi, the coast, and all points east, came the cheerful, irregular songs of India and Gujarat and Hindi. The most attractive oriental sounds of all. One night, high above the Charlemagne, I went to bed early and came from hearing a retransmission of a festival hall concert in London due to begin at 9:30. I tuned into the shortwave and turned the volume down to a mere breath of sound to dampen either a quiz program or a spelling bee. The radio's twitter and buzz about a yard from my ear, and I fell asleep. Shortly before midnight, I awoke to find the blades of four spears outlined against the sky. The shafts were held by four young Samburu, who were kneeling with their heads baked down over the radio. They were listening to the whine of a late-night dance band. Softly, I asked them if they liked it. They ran away. Calling them back,
I repeated the question. Was it good? Did they like the noise? In a phrase which I treasure, one of them said it was Asali Kabisa, the very essence of trouble. They walked out into the dark night. I found myself unable to sleep. I turned to Peter and said, Peter, tell us a story. And Peter said, I can't remember any stories. Then tell us the story about memory. And Peter proceeded as follows. One is a crystal gazer in the attentive time. Its shadows move in a transparent sphere, and the lights must be precisely placed and precisely graded for one to be able to see them at all. Open the flaps, let in the sunlight, and one is looking at an empty glass bar. But now, having seen and recorded all there is by way of shadows, I can begin to compare my perceptions with the real world. Besides, it's still night. Outside, it's still dark. And green ripples outside this tent. I love the charm. It's time for thinking about the future, not the past. So John turned to Edward and said, Edward, tell us a story. A utopian story. And Edward proceeded as follows.
Once upon a time, long ago, for a long time to come, the earth becomes poison, and people live underground. While they had periodically been able to go up to the surface and have a look around, eventually, terrestrial vision was abolished, and with them, of course, terrestrial noise. Except for a few terrestrials who complained that they would not have access to their subject matter, the development was accepted quietly. Those who still wanted to know what the earth was like had, after all, only written to some grandmother, or looking to some cinematographer. And even the lecturer acquiesced when they found that the lecturer seemed nonetheless different when compiled out of other lectures that had already been delivered on the same subject.
Beware of first-hand ideas, exclaimed one of the most advanced of them. First-hand ideas do not really exist. They are but the physical impressions produced by love and fear. And on this gross foundation, who could erect a philosophy? Let your ideas be second-hand, and if possible, fifth-hand, for then they will be far removed from that disturbing element, direct observation. Do not learn anything about this subject of mine, the French Revolution. Learn instead what I think the inner karma thought, Odinson thought, Good thought, Ho Young thought, Chivo Singh thought, Arcadio Hearn thought, Carlyle thought, Mirabeau said about the French Revolution. Through the medium of these eight great minds, the blood that was shed in Paris and the windows that were broken in Versailles would be clarified to an idea which you may employ most profitably in your daily lives. But be sure that the intermediaries are many and varied, for in history, one authority exists to counteract another, each to tell us a different story or a different version of the story. Here, tell us a story.
And here proceeded as follows. That's all well and good, but it can be overdone. Think of some museum displays, musty with documentation, laden with earnest didacticism, and the occasion for private meditation, drowned out by the whir and clatter of the audiovisual program. Certain kinds of material demand so many layers of explication that one begins to wonder whether the game is worth the candle. Consider an exhibition of medieval art, in which a significant part of the show is taken up with a display of illuminated manuscripts. Imagine that the organizers especially wanted to include one small item, a prayer book, rich in lapis and gold, exquisite in itself, but with unusual marginal annotations, some clearly by a later hand. The book is tiny, the Latin text, medieval Latin at that, hard to read, the marginalia even smaller and more illegible. The marginalia, interestingly enough, turn out to be observations of a pharmacological nature, including what is, unmistakably, a remedy for syphilis. Though whether from a priestly hand or not, it's impossible to say. The book, as I say, is tiny. It is also extremely valuable, highly fragile, and susceptible to life. It would almost certainly be displayed in an alarmed showcase behind armored glass and exposed to very low light levels. It would, frankly, be virtually impossible to see. In order to reveal any degree of detail present in the original, our cunning designer would arrange for an enlarged color photograph of the best quality to be displayed alongside the object. The Latin text, and especially the marginalia, would, however, still be more or less illegible because of the handwriting. So it would be important to have a transcription, nicely printed, of course, which could be placed alongside the photograph. Unfortunately, since so few people speak Latin these days, it would also be necessary to have a translation. While a further text might comment on the historical significance of the item in question, the unusual content of the marginal annotations, and on such matters as provenance and dating. At which point, one begins to wonder about the fate of the poor little object, swamped by adjacent material so extensive, so much larger, so much more demanding of our attention. Is it really best served by such a manner of presentation? And if this wealth of adjunct material is really so important, does one need, one dares ask, to have the original object physically present at all? Peter got up and went to look for more wood. Philip moved into his place closer by the fire. John turned to him and said, "Philip, tell us a story. Scholarly, but less pedantic, please." And Philip proceeded as follows.
Toward the end of Gaudy Night, Lord Peter is invited to dine at Highfield at Shrewsbury College, where the chief topic of conversation is, naturally, women's education. The warden maintains that Carlyle has surely added women's education to his three great elements of modern civilization. Peter finished the reference for him. "Gunpowder printing in the Protestant religion, isn't it?" "You are extensively right, Lord Peter," she responds. "A facility for quotation covers the absence of original thought, warden." The warden smiles. "I think you are excessively modest. The act of quotation is no mere intellectual sleight of hand. It is a form of wisdom. If Serres had been a more typical writer, the conversation would have stopped at a bolt of lightning shot through the opposite sky, and the rain held it down. It would have been a dark and stormy night. The kind of night I might have rolled over sleepless and wished for Dorothy to tell me a story. And Dorothy would have proceeded as follows. That's not how I remember it. Toward the end of Gaudy Night, Lord Peter is invited to dine at High Table at Shrewsbury College, where the chief topic of conversation is, naturally, philosophy. The warden asks, how would you define the philosophic mind, Lord Peter? I wouldn't. Definitions are dangerous. But I know that philosophy is a closed book to me, as music is to the tone deaf. The warden looked at him quickly. He presented her with an innocent profile, drooping and contemplative over his plate, like a heron leading a white pond. A very apt illustration, said the warden. As it happens, I'm tone deaf myself. Are you? I thought you might be, he said equably. That's interesting. How can you tell? There is something in the quality of the voice. He offered candid gray eyes for examination. But it's not a very safe conclusion to draw. And as you may have noticed, I didn't draw. That is the art of the charlatan, to induce a confession and present it as the result of deduction. I see, said Dr. Barry. You expose your technique very frankly. You would have seen through it in any case. So it is better to expose oneself and acquire an unmerited reputation of candor. The great advantage about telling the truth is that nobody ever believes it. If this had been a real murder, if, say, there were a murder in it, the conversation might have stopped as a bolt of lightning shot through the opposite sky and the rain passed down. It would have been dark and stormy. I would have heard the real Mr. Rabbit and said, Dick, tell us a story. And Dick would have proceeded as before. There's a story about the teacher Gerhard Richter, who came originally from East Germany. He studied at the Academy of Fine Arts in Dresden, and at that time in East Germany, he was trained in social realism. Apparently, Richter was rather good at it. I don't know if he knows his work, but he had faith that he would be good at it. Still, at some point in the early 60s, he decided to come west. And he was smart enough to realize that all his training and experience and knowledge about painting had absolutely zip to do with contemporary art, just nothing left. So, apparently, what he did in order to make up was to buy the catalogs from the most recent documentary, the big art chamber at Berlin Castle every few years. Then, to find all the skills that Dresden had in the library, he copied all the art in the catalogs from the reproduction. Painting, sculptures, handwork, stories, performances. Painted them all the same, as if there were no difference in substance, which, of course, in photo reproduction is the case. I have no idea if the story is true. A staff writer told it to me one night, when he saw it in Spain.
Peter interrupted. How do you even know what is true and what is not? How do you distinguish between real memory and intention masquerading in memory? Of course, in my trade, I frequently have to extract fictional impurities from the accounts of supposedly reliable witnesses. Where is that? Somebody has added a bit of shaping embroidery to a favorite anecdote, and has then retold it so often that he can no longer remember not seeing what his tongue has got into the habit of saying he saw. But as I listen to you, I am trying to extract factual impurities from a fictional group. I want a story. And W.C. proceeded as follows. One night, a dark and stormy one, back when I was riding the rails, I awoke to find that a lean, re-jointed black man had commenced plunking on a guitar beside me while I slept. His clothes were red, his feet peeked out of his shoes, his face had on it some of that sadness of ages. As he played, he pressed a knife on the strings of the guitar in a manner popularized by Hawaiian guitarists who used steel bars. His song, too, struck me instantly. Going where the southern cross the dawn. The singer repeated the line three times. Going where the southern cross the dawn. Going where the southern cross the dawn. Accompanying himself on the guitar with the weirdest music I had ever heard. I asked the man to tell me the story, or the story of his song, and he proceeded as follows.
Well, this old song might be called down to the name. The reason on record is hard to find. The bell that was made. Ain't on record, it's hard to find. The village that used to play a long time ago, they sing the same verse. And they ain't gonna play a bit longer when the record is close to go. Well, now they just get to play it. And as long as the people join the record and dance, they play it on it. You just need to play it. Where you get the verses from, where you have to get verses out of records, you can get a verse out of each of them and make you a record of your own, by Jasper.
But Jasper just looked inscrutable and said,
not. Do something to it. Do something else 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 to it. Nick interrupted. Yeah, we've heard that one before. I want to hear a real story. And Sarah proceeded.
This is a story about Italian painting, about the paintings of a particular church in Verona. Now I want you to suppose that at some time around the turn of the century, the committee, or whatever it was, in charge of the church of St. Nicholas in Verona had a meeting, and that one of the members pointed out that on one of the walls they had a rather boring blank space, which would look much better with a picture over it. And that another, while agreeing that this was the case, said it simply wasn't on, because all around the space were a lot of nice pictures by Bastiani and other great masters of the 17th century, and it'd have to be something that fitted in with them, and they didn't paint pictures the way Bassetti did anymore. To which the first speaker replied that in the next village but one, there was a young man called, let's say, John Smith, or since my hypothesis is set in Italy, Giovanni Fabro, who could paint, if called on to do so, just like Bassanio, or indeed like any of the other great Italian masters, who could produce, in short, the sort of thing that the speaker, while not professing to be an expert in such matters, would personally be prepared to call. So, Giovanni is instructed to do a nice Madonna in the style of Bassetti. His reputation spreading, he is commissioned to do similar work by other churches and by private patrons with the occasional gap between old masters on the walls of their villas and palazzos. I should like you now to assume the First World War, and as a result of it, many strange vicissitudes and reversals of fortune, leading to the disposal of a number of valuable collections. And when the collection of the Barone di Questo or the Conte di Quello comes up for auction, and it is well established on the best possible authority that the Barone's ancestors had commissioned a number of paintings by Veronese, it is unlikely to occur to anyone that out of six paintings which all look like the works of Veronese, one is actually the work of Giovanni Fabbro. Assume now, however, the passing of the years and the development of more sophisticated technologies in the authentication of paintings, so that various collectors gradually discover that some of the great Italian masters which they are proud to possess are in fact the work of an unknown 20th century colonist. What do you think happens then? Much closer, I should think. But then, my dears, when the dust has settled a little and the national and the men are selling off these impostures for what they can get, it occurs to people that old Giovanni must have been rather a clever chap to do these convincing imitations, which have taken in all the experts for such a long time. So they start thinking that if they can't afford a real Titian or a Veronese, a genuine forgery by Giovanni Fabbro might well be the next best thing. With the result, dear children, that among a certain section of collectors, forgeries by Fabbro have become rather sought after and, in consequence, valuable. It is not improbable. It's more or less exactly what happened with Van Meter, with whom the point has now been reached at which people are forging Van Meter in forgeries. Guy dragged over another piece of driftwood and threw it on the fire. That was good, but it reminded me of one I heard before from a student of mine named Sam. The storm is still flashing, and it's cold till dawn. Somebody tell us another. And David proceeded as follows. It was a good time. We read it on the sea. Remember the fight. Exactly the same. With the guy. So many layers. Humpty Dumpty. The television. No. I'm seeing what it's about. You're going where the southern coast is over. Come on. Do something else. Do something else. They're boring. Like, oh, I know that. Annotation.
Less pedantic.
Less pedantic. So many open the plan. Made a little difference to it. Exactly the same. Mother of the world. These are the kind of things that was happening all over. Oh, different. Something there. Oh, what are the passing of the years? It was a dark and stormy. You remember it was a mega. Great. But what was the mega? Some of the marginal.
That's
for later. What's great? What happened to open? Your different story. Or a different version. I forget a little more. It was a dark yellow. No one, of course, believed him.
Do you like what? Nothing. What was it?
You remember Humpty Dumpty did his own. I've no idea. Tell us another. Excuse me, great other. So many layers. Marginal Hannity. Gunpowder. Hey, oh, yeah, a bolt of lightning shot. Tell us an eye. My eyes. Different substance. Where's the... Oh, going where the sudden rust is all. Boring. Thanks, mate. We were much better with the past of the years than the morning. But a different story. So, and a remedy. Marginal. Hannity. And the rule of the pathetic. You remember Humpty? Twist of the dial. The radio. Open your...
A production of Baltimore Media.